is for what's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Iraqi forces say they're preparing to enter the city of Mosul 2 weeks after launching an offensive to retake it from Islamic State defenders. Special forces entered the last village in front of the city's eastern edge Monday. They now stand just a few hundred meters from the city's limits. U.S. Defense spokesman Peter Cook Monday said U.S. officials are pleased with the progress made.
We have seen reports from Iraqi forces that they are in some places less than a kilometer from Mosul itself. While distance is not the best measure of the fight ahead and the coalition is prepared for difficult fighting ahead, there is no question that counter-ISIL forces continue to have the momentum in this fight.
The Pentagon estimates as many as 7,500 IS fighters could be defending the city. Cook said mass civilian displacements so far have not yet occurred.
There have been people, displaced people, who have left some of these villages, for example, and been able to go to some of these UN aid centers. They haven't been as big in numbers as some initially thought might happen.
Iraqi state television reports IS defenders are also fighting with some of the hundreds of thousands of civilians still in Mosul who've risen up against the militants. France Monday formally ended its peacekeeping mission in Central African Republic, a 3-year mission to stabilize the country riven by sectarian violence since a 2012 coup.
L'opération militaire Sangaris s'arrête, mais la présence de la France ne s'arrête pas.
French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said the French presence, however, is not ending, with French troops still part of the UN MINUSCA peacekeeping force. And the French, he said, would continue providing training and support to the CAR armed forces. Last week, clashes between rifle militia groups killed at least 25 people. This is VOA News. The UN humanitarian chief warned the UN Security Council Monday that war-torn Yemen is a step away from famine. Stephen O'Brien said more than 21 million people, 80% of the Yemeni population, are in need of some form of aid. He spoke by phone from Bahrain.
The parties, their proxies, and those with influence over them, namely the Yemeni government, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the regional Gulf nations and the Gulf Cooperation Council, the United States of America, the United Kingdom, and other Western partners of KSA all have key roles and influence, as do the Houthi authorities, the former President Saleh and his supporters, and Iran. They can arrest this war and this suffering.
UN Special Envoy Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed told the Council rejection of his latest peace plan for Yemen by both Houthi rebels and the government demonstrates the political elite remains unable to overcome their differences and prioritize the national interest. In the embattled Syrian city Aleppo, reports indicate a rebel effort to end the siege by government forces slowed somewhat Monday after launching a fierce counterattack Friday. On Monday, regime forces vowed to repel the rebel attack on western Aleppo. Venezuela's embattled government and the opposition have agreed to hold Vatican-mediated talks on their deepening political crisis. Both sides pledged to create a commission to address the crippled economy, electoral schedule, human rights, and the rule of law. President Nicolas Maduro said the process of dialogue for peace must go toward the common interest of the country, and he hopes for good results. The Venezuelan leader met Monday with Thomas Shannon, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, a Latin American expert, in an effort by Washington to support the ongoing dialogue. Georgia's ruling Dream Party has won a decisive second-round parliamentary election, giving it 115 seats, more than 75% of the 150 seats in a ballot held Sunday. Prime Minister Georgi Kirakashvili said he'll use the mandate to prevent others from adjusting the Constitution to suit one particular group. Georgian Dream, which came to power in 2012, is a pro-Western party, but also favors closer ties with Russia. In Italy, plans are being put in place to help some 15,000 people living in temporary accommodation following Sunday's major earthquake. The 6.6 magnitude quake, the sharpest since 1980, caused injuries and damage, but no fatalities. An August quake in the same vicinity of central Italy killed nearly 300. Chinese manufacturing activity in October expanded at the fastest pace in 2 years, a possible sign the world's second-biggest economy is stabilizing. The official Purchasing Managers Index, PMI, stood at 51.2 last month. It was 50.4 in September. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, the first day of November, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian government officials are accused of abusing women and girls displaced by Boko Haram.
Based on those interviews that she did, we identified that sexual abuse, sexual exploitation, and sexual violence against women and girls who have been displaced by Boko Haram, you know, is a very serious problem.
Lisa Gantos is executive director of the Women's Rights Division of the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. Nigeria's Shiites say they face repression from Nigerian security officials. A new report says 95% of journalists murdered around the world in the last decade were local journalists. And Tanzania's President John Magufuli continues his visit to Kenya today, Tuesday.
Kenya ni partner number one katika Africa.
Magufuli told reporters in Nairobi that Kenya is quite important to Tanzania.
That's VOA's Lenny Ruvaga in Nairobi, Kenya. And the World Health Organization says new smoking products and electronic media pose dangers for tobacco control. Those stories for Samson O'Malley's Africa's Post Roundup and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The U.S.-based Human Rights Watch organization says Nigerian officials, soldiers, and police committed rape and other acts of sexual exploitation against women and girls who have escaped Boko Haram captivity. The accusations were made in a report released Monday under the headline, Nigeria Officials Abusing Displaced Women, Girls. Garba Shehu, senior special assistant to President Muhammadu Buhari, told local media that President Buhari has instructed the Inspector General of Police and governors of the affected states to immediately begin an investigation into the allegations. He assured Nigerians and the international community that the allegations will not be taken lightly. Lisa Gantos is executive director of the Women's Rights Division of the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She says the report is based on the accounts of 43 women and girls who had been living in IDP camps in Maiduguri, northern Nigeria.
Well, in late July 2016, we sent one of our senior researchers who covers Nigeria. She interviewed a number of women and girls who are living in seven internally displaced persons camps near Maiduguri. And based on those interviews that she did, we identified that sexual abuse, sexual exploitation, and sexual violence against women and girls who have been displaced by Boko Haram, you know, is a very serious problem. And the government is certainly not doing enough to protect them and ensure that they have access to basic rights and that they're protected from this kind of exploitation.
You said that government officials and other authorities in Nigeria have raped and sexually exploited women. This is sweeping. Are you talking about local government officials or Nigerian federal government officials?
Well, our research shows that there are a range of government officials who are implicated. So we spoke to women and girls who talked about how they had been raped and sexually abused by police officers. So, for example, one of the cases we had was a 17-year-old girl who said that after she had fled Boko Haram attacks in Dikwa, which is a town about 56 miles outside of Maiduguri, a police officer approached her, said that he wanted to help her. She was in the camp. She was extremely vulnerable. As you know, many of the camps are really under-resourced. There's not enough food. There are restrictions on mobility. And ultimately, he raped her. So that's one case. We have also identified cases where you have camp leaders, people who are in charge of food and clothing, who are in charge of helping victims in those camps, who then also forced women and girls to exchange food for sex and so on. So it appears to be fairly widespread and pervasive. As our report shows, our conclusions are based on interviews with 43 women and girls that took place in late July. They were from seven different camps.
Did you bring this to the Nigerian government's attention during the report?
Yes, we did share the information. We wrote to several Nigerian authorities in August requesting comment on the research findings. In particular, we wrote to the Minister of Women Affairs and Social Development. We were promised a meeting with Human Rights Watch on the 5th of September. but we had not yet received her comments at the time we published our findings.
Let me say that I was speaking to a Nigerian military official who directed me to a statement from the spokesman of President Buhari, saying that the president has instructed the Inspector General of Police and state governors of the affected states to immediately commence investigation into the alleged sexual abuse and exploitation of women and girls. Are you hoping that the government will go after the alleged perpetrators?
Yes, I mean, we saw the same statement, so we're pleased, we're tentatively optimistic that that means that the government will initiate a proper investigation into these allegations. Our research reveals that abusers include camp leaders, vigilante groups, police officers, and soldiers. So we hope that once an investigation is completed, we will see proper accountability measures being put in place to sanction abusers and, again, to make sure that victims are protected and have access to a full range of health care and other services.
Liso Gentles is Executive Director of the Women's Rights Division of the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch organization. She was speaking with me from New York City. Nigeria's largest Shiite Muslim group says it is still being unjustly targeted by the Nigerian government and security forces. More than 300 members of the group were killed in a clash with Nigerian soldiers last year. Chika Odua reports from Abuja.
Saifullah Kabir's mother is in prison. The 40-year-old woman has been held there on a court order in the city of Jos, in the Nigerian state of Plateau.
I visited one time. That was last week. She said she don't know what offense have she done.
Meanwhile, Kabir's two sisters are in police detention.
Fatima is 16 years old, while Khalisa is 14 years old. They are not happy with the detention, because they were students.
All three were arrested 2 weeks ago as hundreds of Shiite Muslims gathered in Jos for a religious ceremony called the Day of Ashura. 44 Shia Muslims were arrested and charged with public disturbance, according to the Plateau State Police spokesman Tiopev Turna. Turna says the minors are being held in a cell in a police station, while the adults, like Saifullah's mother, are in prison.
They are with us on the court order. We are not the ones keeping them. It's the court that says they should be taken to prison. Prison says, help us with your facility so that we'll keep them there. But they are in Sepant. They are in a very good facility.
The activities of Nigeria's largest Shiite group, the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, were recently banned in the neighboring state of Kaduna. For decades, the group has experienced tension with the Nigerian government and security forces. In December 2015, 347 Shia Muslims were killed after a clash with Nigerian soldiers at IMN headquarters in the city of Zaria.
They killed women and children. They burned some alive. They destroyed properties. People were mercilessly killed and dumped in a mass grave.
That's Ibrahim Musa, the spokesperson of IMN. He spoke to VOA from an undisclosed location. He's been in hiding ever since the Kaduna state government issued an order for his arrest on October 7th. Musa says he and other Shiite Muslims believe they are being targeted because of their faith and fear that radical Sunni Muslims are behind the attacks on Nigeria's Shiites. IMN leader and founder, cleric Ibrahim Zakzaki, has been held without charge since the clash in December. Six of his nine children died during altercations with Nigerian security forces. During a visit to Nigeria last week, the U.S. Undersecretary of Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell, told VOA that she is worried that what she calls a repression of faith could instigate a larger conflict in the future.
The United States has expressed its concerns and has raised these at the highest levels of the Nigerian government and military.
IMN spokesman Musa says his group is not stoking violence. He says nobody can push the group to take up arms, adding that Islam is a religion of peace. Chika Odua for VOA News, Abuja.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 1st, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send shout-outs to listeners on these, our VOA affiliate station, Brela FM in Nigeria, Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya, Brush FM in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Tanzanian President John Magufuli continues his official visit to Kenya today, Tuesday. The close relations between the two countries were tested this year by regional economic competition. But as Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi, both countries hope to align their interests during the visit.
This is Tanzanian President John Magufuli's first visit to Kenya since assuming office last October.
Kenya ni partner number moja katika Africa.
Magufuli told reporters in Nairobi that Kenya is quite important to Tanzania. He said the Tanzanian Investment Center reports that 529 Kenyan companies have invested in the country, investing around $1.7 billion and creating employment for about 56,000 Tanzanians. The International Monetary Fund has stated that Tanzania is East Africa's fastest growing economy. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta said the countries will revive the Kenya-Tanzanian Joint Commission for Cooperation, JCC, before year's end to enhance investment and trade.
Safari hii ni ya kuimarisha huo uhusiano kati ya nchi zetu.
He says, and I quote, "This trip is meant to strengthen the relations between both countries," end quote. He said, "This visit is meant to emphasize that if Kenya and Tanzania are to succeed in expanding their economies and creating jobs for the youth, then the countries should," and I quote, "walk together." Economic relations between the two states have been somewhat strained. In March this year, Uganda opted to run a large oil pipeline through Tanzania instead of Kenya. Uganda cited security concerns and said the Tanzania route was $1 billion cheaper than the one proposed by Kenya. Tanzania also won a deal to host a new railway that will connect the Democratic Republic of Congo and the East African coast. And just last month, Tanzania pushed the six-member East African community to delay signing an economic partnership agreement with the European Union, which guarantees traders duty-free access to the EU market. Kenya supported signing the treaty. Economic analyst Ali Kansachu of Nairobi-based Reach Management says this week is a chance for Kenyatta to recalibrate relations with Magufuli after a series of setbacks.
Scored some big wins against Kenya, for example, the oil pipeline from Uganda is now going through Tanzania, big win on his part, and also in terms of the railway line, he seems to have prized away the sort of DRC connection. So a worthy adversary, somebody who's obviously very focused on the Tanzanian national interest, but given the current situation, I think Kenya would be wise to try and sort of reset existing relations, look at what can be done to increase trade and seek better alignment as the East African community and the markets open up.
According to data from the Kenya National Bureau of Statistics, Kenya is Tanzania's largest trading partner in Africa. Lenny Ruvaga, VOA News in Nairobi.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says 95% of the journalists murdered around the world over the last 10 years were local reporters, yet many of those responsible have gone unpunished. The CPJ says such impunity is one of the biggest threats to freedom of the press. It has released its new Global Impunity Index. Elizabeth Witchell is the author of the report. From London, she spoke to viewers Ayen Bio.
The situation is very dangerous, and it's more dangerous than ever. We're just seeing a very, very different kinds of threats confronting journalists. You know, we're seeing journalists targeted not just for their work, not just to silence them from something they might be working on or reporting on, but targeted simply because they're journalists. We're seeing threats coming from so many different sides. It's not all governments arresting journalists or government soldiers or police attacking journalists. We're seeing criminal groups that have become very powerful targeting journalists in Mexico. We're seeing, as I said before, we're seeing extremist groups targeting journalists in war-torn areas. We're seeing political groups like in South Sudan targeting journalists.
And Somalia was ranked number one 2 years in a row. Was that surprising at all for you?
We were surprised. surprised last year when Somalia became number one because it surpassed Iraq, which has, without a doubt, just for so many years, had record numbers of journalists murdered and killed, and 99% of them with complete impunity. So for many years, Iraq was far and above the first one. And in Somalia, journalists have been killed year after year after year, and you never saw the huge surge that we used to see in Iraq in the 2005, 2006. But we have just seen a steady number of journalists killed and their killers not caught.
What does this report say about the global trend of impunity?
Out of the numbers of journalists that are murdered for their work, 90% of the cases that the killers get away with it. Between last year and this year, I would actually say we're seeing a few slight, very slight improvements, which is encouraging, but they are really, really very, very small.
How does targeting journalists affect society as a whole?
When there's no consequences for the perpetrator, it sends a very menacing message to the whole media community in that country. So you, of course, start to see you might start seeing self-censorship. You just see it becoming harder and harder for the media to cover important issues. And then that, in turn, creates a huge information gap, whether it's, you know, an understanding of politics and conflict in Somalia and Iraq and Syria, or whether it's learning about being informed about corruption or crime in the Philippines or Mexico. You know, we're starting to see these what is a very damaging information gap. It makes it very difficult for countries like South Sudan that need to build a functioning civil society.
That was Elizabeth Witchell, consultant for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She spoke with VOA's Ian Bior. The World Health Organization says tobacco control efforts are under threat from new smoking products and new advertising possibilities on the internet. As Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, these are some of the issues to be tackled at an international meeting on tobacco control next week in New Delhi, India.
A lot has changed since the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control came into force in 2005. Bans placed on the advertising of tobacco products were grounded on national practices. However, due to the growth of social media and advances made on the internet, WHO says the tobacco industry can now advertise their products to young people across borders. The head of WHO's Tobacco Convention Secretariat, Vera Luisa da Costa e Silva, says it is easy for young people to download films and the cigarette ads that appear online. She tells VOA the film industry, from Hollywood to Bollywood, exerts a strong influence on the behavior of young people.
There are a number of studies showing a clear correlation between the social acceptability and taking up and consuming tobacco through the influence exerted by pop stars, by film, actors and actresses, and by the film industry itself.
Costa e Silva says a rating system to keep children from watching films advertising tobacco is one of the proposals likely to come up at the New Delhi conference. The WHO says there is increasing recognition of the need to regulate the growing prevalence of smokeless and water pipe tobacco use. Tibor Zilai, an officer in the Tobacco Convention Secretariat, says water pipes are very harmful. While their use is common in the Middle East, he says they are an emerging product in other regions.
And in case of water pipes, we have the evidence there that it is more dangerous than regular cigarette smoking. They are saying that one session of water pipe tobacco use is equal to 100 cigarettes smoked.
Zilai warns tobacco companies are coming up with harmful new approaches for marketing this product. For instance, he says the tobacco used in water pipes now come in a variety of aromatic, fruity flavors. Another gimmick, he says, is the floating water pipe, which can be inhaled while floating on the sea. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here's Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria, with this morning's roundup of Africa Sports.
Good morning, James. We begin with the Super Eagles, where one of the 24 players named by Super Eagles of Nigeria coach Garrett Raw for the game against Algeria on November 12th has decided to opt out of the crucial World Cup qualifier. Ado The Hague right-back Tryon Ebuhe said he decided to withdraw because his club requires his full attention, especially now that he has just settled in into the team, but all the same considers the call-up as an honor. The 20-year-old defender, who was born in Harlem in the Netherlands, is still eligible to play for Nigeria and the Netherlands. Officials of the Niger senior women's national team, the Super Falcons, have denied some media reports that the team threatened to boycott the 2016 African Women Cup of Nations due to unpaid allowances. Media officer of the team, Remi Shoshola, however, confirmed that the team had yet to be paid some allowances, but that it had not deterred them from training hard for the competition. One of those who had gone without pay for an upward of 8 months is coach of the team, Florence Omagbemi. The 10th African Women Cup of Nations is billed for Cameroon from November 19th to December the 3rd. And on a sad note, the Gambian Football Federation has expressed shock at the news of the death of the Gambian women's senior national team goalkeeper, Jawara Fatim, who died while attempting to move over to Europe by boat. Fatim met her sudden death on attempt to cross to Europe through Libya, where she said to have spent weeks in a secluded camp in Misrata. GFF boss Lamine Kababajo described Jawara Fatim as a talent who will be missed. And to Ghana, where management of Accra Hearts of Oak is expected to meet this week to appoint a new coach ahead of the new season. The Phobians are currently without a coach after the sudden resignation of Yua Preko, who exited the club last Friday. Unconfirmed reports say Ashanti Gold coach Bashir Hayford is in the running for the top job. And to Egypt, where three-time world squash champion and Egyptian player Rami Ashour has reached the quarterfinals of the World Squash Championship after defeating Daryl Selby of England 3-1. Ashour will face his fellow countryman Fariz Dezoski, who beat Nafizwan Adnan of Malaysia 3-2. In South Africa, nominees for the 2016 South African Sports Awards have been unveiled. Announcing the names on Monday, Olympian gold medalist Wade van Niekerk and Caster Semenya are among the nominees for the 2016 South African Sports Star of the Year Award. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, for that roundup of Africa Sports. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spearheaded renewed efforts on Monday to bolster Libya's UN-backed government against continued chaos and a collapsing economy. But the meeting appeared to yield little more than an expression of support for the embattled Libyan leadership. Kerry and British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson convened the gathering in London that included ministers from France, Italy, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, who met with Libyan Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj. Human rights monitors are accusing Nigerian officials, soldiers, and police of rape and other acts of sexual exploitation against women and girls who have escaped Boko Haram captivity for what they falsely believed to be the safety of government encampments. Human Rights Watch leveled the accusations in a report released on Monday under the headline, Nigeria Officials Abusing Displaced Women and Girls. And that's it for this Tuesday, November 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Tuesday, November 8th, the American people will choose their new president. This historic campaign comes to an end and a new president is chosen. Our coverage will feature all of VOA's correspondents across the U.S. and around the world. Tune into our live comprehensive coverage between 00 and 0300 UTC GMT Wednesday morning, November 9th, right here on VOA.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the electoral process and presidential elections in the United States. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.